Recording. Okay, so this is the most important lecture in the course. And I can tell by the attendance. I should have told them yesterday that this one. I did actually. I said we'd be talking about transistors today. And if you've read it all about transistors on the web, you'll see that they are quite mind-boggling. Who has read as far as transistors now? There are actually two chapters, transistors and transistors underscore LO for local oscillator, depending on whether you want to learn about amplifiers or oscillators, okay? And in this lecture, I'm going to describe the transistor at radio frequency, look at the equivalent circuit, there's only one I ever use, for all small signal transistors, S parameters, Y parameters, and solve. Without solve, you cannot do anything in this course, unless, of course, you're a PSPICE expert. There are no other choices. Oh, apart from $50,000 packages, but which are by all means free to use. Stability of transistor amplifiers, just very briefly I'll cover that. It's an annoying little aspect of design I tend not to worry about. I just build a circuit and then fix up the oscillation when it occurs by studying it, whereas in actual fact there are some simple formulae that tell you whether a transistor will oscillate. Now, what I'm referring to there with stability, okay, I can see blank faces. When you make a transistor amplifier for audio, it just works, right? If you're like, yeah, they can also oscillate. Sometimes, annoyingly, they produce signal by themselves without your input. When you make an amplifier that does that, you're in trouble, okay? So, so there we have to be pretty careful about how our design work goes. Then we're going to look at the clap radio frequency oscillator. It's called a clap oscillator. You may have also heard of Hartley oscillators and Colpitts oscillators. This one's just a slightly different variation on that. And the clap oscillator is an oscillator. So now you're making a transistor amplifier do the oscillation. And of course you want to be guaranteed that it'll oscillate. And I'll do a complete solve example using the oscillator. It's actually already on the web, although I always improve my web notes whenever I look at them. Let's have a look at transistors. All right. You can keep passing that helical resonator around and wonder at it. In actual fact, what we did in the last lecture was learn how to design one of those. Okay. However, you can see that, you may remember, actually, I'm interrupting the train of thought here, but you may remember that what you have, of course, is we only designed for two of these, right? Two side-by-side, effectively, those two, because they're the ones that can see one another. Did you all notice the little slot in the wall down the bottom there? Well, that's the coupling capacitor. Okay? That slot in the wall is the coupling capacitor. That's how those coils feel one another. If there were no slot in the wall anywhere and the lid were on it, what would this be? It would be a paperweight. As you can see, they make a good paperweight, didn't it? Have a look at this helical resonator filter. This is what we learned to design in the last lecture. We only did the two-stage, and also we did it in the lumped element version where we had capacitors, right? So if I drew it up on the board, by all means, come in. This is the most important lecture, and I think I'm recording it, but I never know that I've actually recorded something until I hear it played back to me. And Bridget, you'll want to see what I've stolen this out of a MOCOM 70 Motorola transceiver for 20 watts, 433 megahertz ISM band. And yesterday we learned how to design these narrow bandpass filters that look like this. I'm hoping sort of by now that you guys can start to see when you look at a work of art such as is that helical resonator filter, how this circuit we learned to design yesterday actually describes this, okay? If you look down the coils in the cavities, Bridget, you'll see slots in the walls. And those are coupled two by two, okay? In sequence all around, okay? So they all look like this. Oh, you can't see that. Shouldn't bring this around. They all look like this, okay? So you have a tap that goes into that coil. The coil is the coil, right? But this capacitor is also in the coil because they're about a quarter wavelength at 433 megahertz. So if you stretch those coils out, how long will that be?
What's the wavelength at 433 megahertz? Yeah, it's a hard sum, isn't it? 3 by 10 to the 8 divided by 433 by 10 to the 6 is 70 centimeters. All right, so they're a quarter of 70. They're about 17 centimeters long when you stretch them out, those coils. So they're going to be a quarter wavelength, and because of that, you don't need a capacitor in there, in that thing, right? The coils do it for you, and you'll notice that they're big fat coils. Why would you make them big fat coils? What's good about big and fat? Remember this circuit, each one of those coils is surrounded by a cavity, and that cavity prevents the field from the coil from radiating all over the place. When a coil like that is like a quarter of a wavelength long, it's a monopole antenna, and it's going to have a radiation resistance of 32 ohms, about 30 ohms, that's a lot of resistance. So they put it in a cavity so it can't radiate. That's what we have the cavity for. But there's still a problem. If you get rid of the external impedance, you still have the internal impedance, right? And but unfortunately, the internal impedance has the same reactance and resistance. They're both equal, as components. Remember the surface impedance that was the Z impedance per square multiplied by 1 plus J. In order to get that down, what they do is they make the coils fat, so that there's a bigger path for the current to flow along. And they coat the coils in something that's of high conductivity, usually silver. Silver's a good choice because gold's a worse conductor, and it's also expensive, but it's a little less, doesn't tarnish like silver does. Remains gold, okay? So they make these big fat, can't draw a big fat coil, but you get the picture, right? Big fat coils, kind of. And now, that means that we got rid of these capacitors by running these on a half wavelength. They also get rid of that capacitor by putting in a slot. So these guys, in order to prevent their radiation resistance from dominating, they put them in a cavity. And in order to prevent them, their internal impedance from causing losses, they make them big and fat and coat them in silver. And then to make them feel one another, because in order you have to have that coupling capacitor, they put a little cut in the wall so they can peep at each other. And by occluding that cut, you can vary the coupling capacitor. So these are actually running at quite high voltage. You get a serious burn if you touch them when they're in action, right? There's nothing stopping the voltage on these from getting too high. And so at high powers, it becomes an issue whether the air will break down inside the cavities. But I think at 20 watts. All right? Anyway, I'll let you pass that around. Think about this in the context of the last lecture, and you'll understand once you get some practice designing these circuits, as you will in your project. If everybody shows project one, you'll all... You didn't say what project you were
doing. I'm with
senior. I'll tell you what I'll say project one, too. Then you're going to have to be able to design narrowband filters. When you start doing your homework on preselectors for superheterodyne receivers with a low IF, you'll find you have a serious image problem. So you need a narrowband preselector. You don't use the designs in Boeing. Well, you don't, but the other guys will. The other guys will. No, neither of them here. Okay? Alright, so let me get back. This is the most important lecture in the course. I'm teaching you today how to deal with transistors at radio frequency. So who has met transistor before? Who's designed audio transistor type things that go to 100 kilohertz? Have you ever made a transistor circuit? You haven't. You have. One person's made a transistor. Well, you're all going to be diving in at the deep. Sorry. Well, in the very least, design it with spice or something. Obviously, it wasn't sold. Unless you've known some of the students who've done this class before, so hey, there's this great program called Solve here. But who's designed a transistor off our circuits before, or even an oscillator for 10 kilohertz or 100 kilohertz? Who did Salman Durrani's electronics course? You did. So that's what you did, yeah.
We designed them.
You just used them?
Yeah.
Did you actually see the transistor? And was it a transistor amplifier?
You analysed it with what software?
Please,
right. Okay, so. You did the quiescent bias. Is that what you mean by that?
Well, the
voltage and current levels of the transistor, that's very important. We're going to review that today. In other words, you have to know the quiescent operating condition of the transistor, and you have to design the circuit so that it has one, and the transistors conduct before at least you know it's going to conduct. When you do power amplifiers, you find it's better that they don't conduct, it's better that they be turned off, and then you turn them on for a part of the cycle. But in common emitter amplifiers, for low noise amplifiers, and all many other applications, you look at low power, you design them to be turned on a bit for operation. Yeah, that's called determining quiescent bias. So can you explain in those terms what you did?
Absolutely. I have no idea what you mean.
Quiescent means that static operating condition.
Well, I'll go ahead with the lecture and tell me, please, where you don't know what I'm talking about, okay? Like quiescent's a word I use all the time. I'm a quiescent person. Anyway, transistors. More complex, that's the first thing you're going to see. There are a number of ways you cop out in doing transistor design. First thing is to go to, is it Motorola or Agilent, and buy ABS. Then design circuit board cadence and design your own transistors, have them built. Next thing you do is you've got to buy transistors from Farnell, so you use PSPICE. PSPICE will have all the S parameters in it for very popular transistors. And I don't know how PSPICE works, but presumably you pay for it, like everything you like, right? Alternatively, you go to the S parameters manufacturers for S parameters. They are morally obliged to give them to you, okay? Or you use a simulation package that's what I just said when I was saying PSPICE. Failing this, we roll our own. And this is what this lecture's about, okay? So this is the first step, right? And this is the first thing you ever have to unlearn when you're an RF engineer. But without doing this, you don't know what you're doing. Okay? It gets a bit more and more desperate, of course. If you can't get the information from manufacturers, yes, parameters are not in the data sheet, then what do you do? And that's what this lecture's about, actually. Because the BF199, which I replaced the MRF157 Motorola transistor with a long time ago, 2 years ago, has a very poor data sheet, as you'll see. So that's good. And here it is. It's a BF199. It's a VHF transistor. As we will see, there's what it looks like. You can see by turning it upside, it's a visit symbol. You can see by turning it upside down that it, what its pins correspond to. Okay, base, emitter, collector. We all understand those terms. That's what the transistor looked like. It's about the size of a pea and it's black. I've never seen any other colour. So it's a low current, low voltage, 25 volts. That's high voltage. That's good. They say low, it's high for me. NPN, that's the style of transistor that it is. All the ideas I'm talking about today equally apply to PNP, bipolar junction transistors, and FETs. I don't deal with FETs in the course. Oh, yes, there is. The 2N7000 power amplifier is a FET. Use the same ideas. More details on that in power amplifiers. Right, the main things you're going to want to know are HFE, which is your beta, has a minimum value of 38, and that's a DC, obviously. It's a DC parameter, but we still use it at RF. And the other one is, the really important one is FT. That's the, they call it the transition frequency. That's the unity gain bandwidth. That's where the transistor's S21S parameter goes through 1. And that occurs at 550 megahertz. And obviously you want that to be a lot higher than your operating frequency, because this transistor is a very pathetic doorstop when that frequency occurs. It's not a transistor anymore, it has no gain. So we keep away from it. All right, there it is. Now, who's seen distributed diagrams of transistors before?
Who has ever done the small signal analysis of a transistor? Yeah, okay.
So, there's the radio equivalent, okay? And the aim is to determine all those parameters, which I must admit, we mostly guess, okay? Right, so what's present in the low-frequency transistor?
Well, these are all the elements. Here's the base, the emitter and the collector, and I hope you know what those terms mean. That's fundamental in this lecture. Well, that could probably be there at DC, and that certainly is. That's an important resistor RBE for the transistor. You can determine that from the collector current. The collector current flows in here, the emitter current flows down here, and that tiny base current flows there. The transistor still acts as a current source with beta IB, where beta is the DC beta, the low frequency beta current gain, which is also HFE. Okay? The things you don't get at DC, most importantly, are these capacitors. This is the Miller capacitance, the feedback, and it's about 0.5 of a picofarad for the VF199, and it's a very important contribution to its operation, and it's documented, interestingly enough. The transition frequency, or the unity gain bandwidth of the transistor, is dependent upon CBE, which is 100 picofarads for the VF199. Now you'll see VF199 is probably mostly used, in fact, in audio oscillators or amplifiers for that reason. 100 picofarads. If you've got a feeling for how big that is, by all means, calculate now what that is at 50 megahertz. You'll find it's a tiny number. And it's absolutely typical of all radio transistors that they have very low input impedance because of CBE, especially FETs. You could even have nanofarads, of input capacitance in a power VHF FET. Very high frequency field effect transistor. You know all that? There are different types of FETs, MOSFET, LDMOS, PMOS. Heard of FETs, field effect transistors? Junction FET was the basic one that existed when I was a boy, and then there are many more that have come since. Bipolar junction transistors by the same token, almost all the same, there's only about one type. Okay. Alright, so, and these are the lead inductances. I usually take 1.5 nanohenries for those in a good design, as low as you can get it. Okay? Right, so there are all those ugly things, and it's those things that determine the S parameters, okay? All right, so here's a more detailed page of there. They don't have that, that's me, but this is the data sheet again for the VF199, and you'll see the Miller capacitance, 0.5 picofarads and FT 550 megahertz, and the thing you have to notice is where these were taken. This was taken at 5 milliamps collector current with a collector to emitter voltage of 10 volts. Don't ask me why they've got a frequency of 100 megahertz in here. On the other hand, the feedback capacitance would depend on the frequency, and it's taken with zero current at the collector, so it's just the transistors almost not operating when they measure it, and they get 0.5 of a picofarad, and that's the capacitance between the collector and the base. Notice that they don't mention CBE, that big capacitor I was telling you about. In other words, seemingly, to the uninitiated, they don't give you the most important bit of information you need to understand the transistor. Now, that's a particularly bad example. You can often do better than that if you're trying to find out transistor data, and they'll often give you a Smith chart and S parameters, okay? All right. So a Smith chart being just a graphical way of representing impedances, by the way, for all of those who've looked at the spectrum analyzer and so far. All right. And in an earlier lecture, I showed you that there's this complicated looking set of algebraic equations to convert from S parameters into Y parameters. We use that. We need to know that because S parameters are usually what we have to compare with. They're the lingua franca of the measuring people who measure transistor properties. But we need Y parameters for solve. In fact, you need Y parameters for any circuit calculation. So we need to be able to convert. All right, now let's get to it. Definition first on Y parameters. That's a recapitulation. There's a transistor. It's been modelled as a four-port device. I say four even though there are three because the emitter is common between the input and the output. Okay? And the input current, all the currents always... certainly in the definition of S parameters, but also in solve, currents always flow into the node. Okay, so that's why I've got as currents crashing into one another, okay, across the base and the collector, and they obviously flow out through the emitter. Okay, that's true, by the way, in all of this. The radio frequency you're doing, it's actually probably, it's not necessary actually. The S parameters will determine that, but I assume that the currents going into the base and emitter emerge at the collector still. Okay, that's a nice thing to know. It wasn't a given, but it's a nice thing to know. Okay, so there we have the YIVEB. You also notice that they use the same convention as I do for the sense. E to B is the emitter to base voltage, where it's positive on the base and negative on the emitter. And VEC across from the collector to emitter, and we have the definitions of the four parameters. YF being the forward gain from EB to the output is obviously the one that gives the transistor its gain. Okay, we want that to be, I don't know, 20 dB, some large number. The bigger it is, the more the transistor can be an amplifier and an oscillator, by the way. All right, so probably the main problem in this lecture is going to be maybe to remember those symbols. All right, now what we're doing is converting this so we can use it in solve. It would have been a good idea to put that up there again, but let's have a look at this. I'll just draw it on the board here so you can see it. Base, collector, emitter. All right. And we have the current IB going into the base, the current IC going into the collector, and the current IE going into the emitter. So I add another equation, okay, in order this is for solve now. Remember in solve what we need are those admittances across the impedances. Now, we're jumping in at the deep end a bit here because I haven't done transformers with you yet or transmission lines, and they're actually simpler than transistors to solve. All we've ever done are single impedances with solve. And you may remember if I have a particular node in the circuit, say the ith node, okay, and this is coming from the jth node, then what I want is yji. Remember there were those two dots there that were a function of frequency, and that'll be 1 over whatever z is, if you've got a single impedance. Remember that? Where the yji is taken from j to I, and the voltage associated with that is negative and positive respectively on j and I. And now we're going to use that idea with the transistor to derive an expression for these things that solve needs in terms of the Y parameters of the transistor. So you can see the hierarchy: S parameters from the manufacturer, Y parameters from those equations I put up on the board, and then these numbers here. So that's what we're going to do. That's what I've done on this, somebody may have already worked out. So what we need in order to solve is we need to find, in terms of the S parameter, the Y parameters, I should say, the expression for all of these node currents, okay? And the first thing is to get IB. We need IB in terms of VEB, right? That's the convention in solve, E to B. That's the first one. Righto, so what is IB in terms of VEB? Let's just go back. Maybe I should write these up on the board over here somewhere. So, in terms of the S parameters, we have II is YI, VEB plus YRVEC, and I out equals YFVEB plus YOVEC. Now you'll see the problem here is the EC bit, because solve doesn't want IB in terms of EC at all. So the first step is, first of all, we know that we've got a coefficient of VEB, which is YI, so I'll put that in. But we also have YR times VEC, and YR, well, it comes out the front,
What is VEC? Well, VEC is equal to VEV, in other words, that from there to there, is this from here to here, minus VCB. Well, because it's actually plus VBC, which is minus VCB. So I can do that. And I can now simplify that to YI plus YR, VEB minus YR VCB. All right, so
see what I've done there? It's the very first equation at the top I've derived.
It's the trick is simply to re-express the definition of the Y parameters so that the currents at each of these nodes are expressed in terms of the voltages from each other side of this. The node is actually at the transistor, right? But expressed in terms of the voltages from each of the other nodes. And so just by rewriting the first depth equation up there for the Y parameters, we now end up with the equation that we can put into solve. So if this was the first node and this is the second and this is the third node in our circuit, we'll have one on each of those, then this would be YI plus YR V21 minus YR CB V13. Okay? V31. Alright? And that would mean that Y21 points, because all of these are functions of frequency, would be YI plus YR. Alright?
Everyone get that idea?
I've got an example at the end of the lecture.
Let's get on. The derivation here is exactly the same. And at the emitter node, we finally have this equation. Just re-expressing so that now we can use solve. Okay? All right. So what I did was I took these... I'm presenting here is an analysis. You'll see the details on the web. But I did an analysis of the BF199 transistor,
except it just for the BF199. Has a base emitter capacitance of 100 picofarads with an FT of 550 megahertz. That's chosen iteratively to get the results to agree with some meager measurements that I found of it. The 0.5 picofarads is the Miller capacitance, the one from the collector back to the base, at a quiescent current of 7 milliamps and using a beta of 100. Okay? And if you do that, I've got four view graphs now I'll quickly go through for each of the S parameters. Remember, S parameters are complex numbers. S11 is the return loss. The absolute magnitude of the return loss, these blue curves here are my calculations. The dotted blue curves, I think, are somebody's piecewise calculation. It's on the web, you can go and look at it. Okay. The red ones are measurements. And the trouble with the measurements is when they... I don't know what they did, but often they have zero here. They're in different places, and so I suppose you should ignore that. I don't know what the meaning of it is. Okay, so this is just from any old where off the web, and you can see that the phase follows. Okay, this jump is a 360 degree jump, which is what happens when phase evolves itself. So that really shouldn't have happened. It should be down here. Okay, this one here would have jumped too, except you didn't quite go low enough. This is probably the worst agreement I've got. What this means is that probably the return loss is a bit better, a bit lower than what I'm calculating, okay? But the reason why it's so... Can anyone guess why it's so bad? I mean, the return loss should be zero, right? If that were matched to 50 ohms, it should be zero. Can anyone guess why it's so bad? If you have a look back at the circuit of the transistor, remember it had that 100 picofarad capacitor? Right across the base to the emitter. That's a dead short, isn't it, at RF? That's why it's so bad. It's a dead short. That's why S11 is so high. Even here it's high. And, well, that's low, but I don't think those mean anything. These are the three points here that correspond to their measurement.
So it's going to be a bit of tweaking because our input return loss is poorly determined by solve. All right, here is Y S21. This is the gain of the transistor. This is the S parameter we want to be big for the transistor to be alive and well. Again, the magnitude and the angle down here. So I haven't got real and imaginary parts, by the way. It's magnitude and angle. And you can see that there's pretty good agreement now, even in the angle, okay? This is 100 megahertz here. So we're watching this go up in frequency. You can see it gets to about 1 at 200, 300. Ah, 200, 500, that should be about 1 there for the unity gain frequency, 550 megahertz, the transition frequency. And so just by adjusting, that's the only thing that determines the base emitter capacitor to be 100 picofarads. Here's the guy robbing you of Gauss signal, right? Right at the input, sucking up all the input current without transferring it to the current source through D-IV. All right, then there's the reverse feedback capacitance. Again, the agreement's pretty good, okay, except for those zero values there. And then there's the output return loss, and that's a lot better, which is a bit of a pain. The output return loss determining the output impedance, and therefore how you match the output of the transistor. All right, so there's an example of what Solve does for you compared with two other opinions about the BF199, the red points being the measurement and the blue points being the piecewise calculation. All right, now just very quickly, I wanted to introduce the concept of the bias of a transistor versus the small signal equivalent of the transistor before I go into giving you an example of how to actually use Solve for a real transistor solution, such as your oscillator, okay? Well, on the left-hand side here, I have the circuit as you would make it, right? 12-volt power supply, can be a car battery, okay? A 50-ohm source that needs amplification. This is an amplifier. It's even got a big choke here. Instead of putting a resistor at the collector, you could put a choke at RF because inductors have big values at RF. So you can get the maximum gain out of the transistor by connecting the power supply directly on at the collector. So this has a collector voltage here of 12 volts DC. Sorry, it should be over here. Because this is a 12 volts, you need a blocking capacitor, and this capacitor here will have a very large value. Why is that? Anyone know why that's the case? You haven't done blocking in audio oscillators or amplifiers, have you? You have.
A year ago.
Oh, yeah. Well, first of all, this is a 50-ohm load, right? I'm going to feed a transmission line directly with this. I haven't even got a matching network on that. I just drew the circuit up, right? To be honest, sorry about that. That L and that C can make an L matching network. That's an L matching network. Then, in that case, this C doesn't have to be big. It has to be the right value so that you match the output of the transistor to that 50 ohms. Okay, it's an L matching network. So you have to know what the output resistance is to use an L-matching network. You'll see it's more like an L-matching network when I look over here. At the moment, it's connected to the supply, and that's very confusing. But very often, this will be a choke, meaning a very high-value inductance, like 10 microhenries, and it doesn't play any role at RF at all. It's an open circuit. And this is a blocking capacitor, which has a very large value. The reason for making this a large value is it's blocking the DC, and sometimes you want a capacitor to be in a circuit to block DC without playing any role in the RF signal analysis at all. Then the capacitor has to have a very large, low inductance value. So 0.1 microfarad, for example, is a short circuit for everything above about a megahertz. Okay? However, it has to be a good 0.1 microfarad. If it has long leads and it has 10 nanoheries of inductance, then it's an open circuit at a gigahertz. Right? So you've got to be careful how you choose these capacitors. This one here plays a similar role, although this is connected at ground here. Oh, sorry, this is the blocker. This is a DC, and so this blocks the transistor base from being shorted to ground. Okay? And now, we want to go. In order to use S... once we set up the bias here by doing the usual calculations for the quiescent collector current that flows without any input signal,
and all the voltages in the circuit, then we set it up so that it approximately corresponds to the value of our S parameters that we have calculated, because the S parameters were only calculated for one collector current, okay? And you set it up for that. Once you do that, the next step is to write the circuit as a small signal equivalent, so you can now use the S parameters, or the Y parameters actually, to compute the response of the circuit to an input signal using solve. To do that, you don't need that 12 volts anymore. At radio frequency, what is a 12 volt car battery? How is it to be viewed? As ground, exactly. It's an RF ground. Does everyone understand why at RF you can just suppress the battery? What you've done is suppress it, by the way. You haven't really shorted it. I'd advise you not to short it for a 12-volt car battery under any conditions. I've done it myself. It can burn anything up to a wire about that thick, completely obliterate it. Not a very pleasant experience. But what is it that you... Can everyone see that when you just put it to ground like that, that you now have equivalent behaving for small signal? Because the small signals, the oscillating parts of the signal, are going to sit on that thing anyway, as if they would around ground, so there's no need for the power supply anymore. Okay? You only needed the power supply to set the transistor upside at the right S parameters. For the small signal analysis, you can get rid of the power supply altogether. And that's an interesting point too, because that implies that in your circuit, the RF signals really do see the 12-volt battery as a short circuit. Now, the only way they're going to do that is if you make sure that it's properly decoupled. And the way you do that in a transistor circuit is that right at the top here, where your lead runs off to the power supply, you put another decoupling capacitor, a bit like this 10 nanofarad one, but you place it across the top lead on your circuit, where it goes to the power supply, to ground, so that all radio frequency currents are passed through that shorting capacitor to ground, and don't have to find their way along your long and tortuous power supply lead back to the 12-volt battery. You put a capacitor there, it will store the 12 volts of the power supply and become a surrogate power supply for your circuit.
Yes.
And it's exactly what you want it to do. Because it's a 12-volt, it's a capacitor, so it stores voltage when you put a voltage across it. In fact, a battery is nothing but a big capacitor, right?
It runs out just like a capacitor discharges. So does everybody have that idea of setting up the first step in any transistor design is to get those S parameters. What are they? That depends on your bias. Set the quiescent bias up. No RF here yet, okay? Then you come over to here and set up the small signal analysis circuit. All right? I'll pass that up because I'm going to... You can easily read about that. All right. I'm going to use the last 10 to 15 minutes of this lecture to do a specific example now.
Okay. Yes. Less than 10 minutes left.
Why is there less than 10 minutes left?
Physics.
Yeah.
Five tenths.
No, they should just finish on the
analogy. Well, I'll do it again.
Right. We're going to model the clap oscillator. All right. I chose to do this one as an example. We model using S and Y parameters. In the project, the oscillator is a VCO, okay? So the MC145170 phase lock loop has to control the frequency of the oscillator by applying a voltage to a varactor or voltage variable capacitor, and that's located in the tanks network, as you've seen, I think, for the oscillator. And what we need to do is prove that the oscillator will oscillate and determine the frequency at which it will oscillate. I know. In solve, what we do, and this is the technique to determine oscillation, we inject a current into the tank circuit of the oscillator and determine the frequency at which the reactance of the input impedance is zero and the resistance is negative. The input resistance is negative. An oscillator has feedback. It's possible that the input resistance of a transistor at radio frequency can be negative. Okay. It's simply a matter of the fact that when the voltage goes up, the current is 180 degrees out of phase and feeding right back into your power supply. And it's possible with active devices. Now, the question is, why does that mean our oscillator will oscillate? All right. So let's have a look. Here's the circuit, and here's the tank circuit. And this point where I break it is where we inject our current source. So this is the DC quiescent transistor oscillator, and this is the small signal equivalent of it. And I've replaced the transistor by good old BEC. So we're going to use our Y parameters. And as you can see here, these are the varactor diodes. In fact, the BB883 varactor that you use in the project is only a single diode. It's not two back-to-back diodes like this anyway. That is, in fact, a blocking capacitor. So that prevents the DC voltage from this bias circuit from being shorted out by that inductor, which is usually connected to ground. And you can see there's another decoupling capacitor here of 10 nanofarads. That's a very large capacitor, which feeds 50 ohms. So this oscillator goes straight out into 50 ohms. In fact, it's a small signal, low power oscillator. I don't even care about matching it. You won't care too much about matching this oscillator. You just want it to give you some signal, right? It's the signal source of your carrier, okay, and your local oscillator. And this is the feedback network. It's the collector current oscillates in phase with the base voltage here that generates the voltage that feeds the tank circuit that keeps it going. And the technique that we use to determine whether or not it will oscillate is by injecting a current in here, as we do in Solve. We always inject 1 ampere into every circuit we study, and we watch for where the resistance goes negative at the point where the reactance goes through zero. When the reactance goes through zero, we know that the open loop response of this circuit is 180 degrees out of phase, as it should be, for instability. Now let's have a look at some of the things we've done here. You can see, first of all, RL is 50 ohms, and this guy is 2K. Well, this is about 1 ohm at 50 megahertz. So RL is just 50 ohms going to ground. I've got a short to the collector because that's a short circuit capacitor. I've neglected this guy altogether. Forget about it. I've also neglected these 33K resistors. They're so big in impedance, they're not going to affect anything in the small signal circuit compared to that CVE here, which is 100 picofarads, right? In addition to that, there's a 43 ohm resistor R1, and there's a 33.3K resistor R2, and there's this 82 picofarad capacitor C2, C1. ZT represents the series combination in actual fact, this diode is connected right across that inductor, so ZT represents the parallel combination of that inductor with the diode, this is a voltage variable capacitor. I think I had a view graph showing this. Yeah, there's a varactor diode, there's the construction of one. You reverse bias them to vary their capacitance, and so by applying a DC voltage to the varactor diode, and here we have it from 1 volt up to about 30 volts, you can see the capacitance. This is our diode, this is the BB883. You can see it varies from about 1 picofarad up to almost 10 picofarads. So that's the tuning element. And when you vary that capacitance, you change the frequency. All right? Anyway, getting back to our circuit, what we have to do now, I've already put the nodes on. 1, 2, 3, 4 on the emitter there. 5 and 6 is ground. So this is a simple N=6 circuit. And let's go. There are 3 steps in this. The first thing we need to do is we run a program, S parameters. You may have noticed that's exactly the program I ran before that computed the S parameters for all frequencies of the DF199. Okay, next step. You remember these equations? Get Y parameters from S parameters. You'll notice it's a bit strange how I've done this. I'm assuming that the S parameters are given, which is what you usually assume. In this exercise, somewhat artificial, because I started off with a theoretical model for the transistor in the first place. Then I worked out the S parameters, only so I could go back and work out the Y parameters. But that's all right. That means this is a more general formulation. N=6 is the number of nodes, and these are the usual things, frequency and zeros, for all the admittances in the circuit, as you would do with Solve. Next thing is to define the circuit parameters. And these are the ones, 43 ohms, 33.3K, RL is 50 ohms, C2, oh, that's a different value. I've got 20 puff, not 82 puff. Oh, different. 10 puff. And these are the values I took. The varactor diode is 2 puff in this, 2 picofarads, so you have to adjust the voltage on it to make it 2 picofarads. This inductance here is enormous and almost unwieldy at 8 microhenries. Okay. And this represents the capacitance across that L, 0.1 picofarad, which is probably unimportant considering CT is already across it. So they're the circuit parameters I'm using. And now, those famous Y values. Well, let's just do a few of these. Let's have a look at the simple one. Y12, Y21. If we go back to our circuit, it's 1 over ZT. Okay? Let's go to another one. Oh, an interesting one. Y42 and Y24. You'll notice that they're not the same. Every other time when I have a simple impedance, the YIJ and the YJI are always the same. That's reciprocity for passive circuit components. Electromagnetic reciprocity. Doesn't work for transistors, they're anisotropic devices. When you walk in the base of a transistor, it's a totally different world to walking in the collector of a transistor. They're not symmetric. So Y24 and Y42 are not the same. Y42 is from, well, in actual fact, on the circuit, it's from here to here. So that was our 4.2 was the looking at the base current. Y24, on the other hand, is looking at the emitter current because we're going from emitter to base. Okay, and you can see, if you go back and check, I gave you the formulae for how to calculate these before. You go back and check them, you can verify all these values. And I'll actually copy this program up onto the web in this format so that you can recognise it from the lecture notes, okay? And you can run it yourself. My final view graph, here it is. This is the input impedance on the current source seen into the oscillator as a function of frequency. And you can see that when the reactance, the imaginary part, goes through zero, we have quite a large negative resistance. And that would indicate that it's going to oscillate at about 42 megahertz. Okay, now I thought I'd give you this big bang lecture because you've got Easter coming up, and so you're going, there's no lectures next week, are there?
No, the next 2 weeks.
Right, well in that case you've got plenty to think about with this lecture, because you're going to need to know this backward to make yourself a little oscillator that will work. Okay, now we have a demo model, but it's you've all got to do your own. Sorry?
Who are you expecting us to be up to with this project? I mean, ideally, we'd love to do something over the holidays, but not the holidays, like the lecture free group. I'm not entirely convinced we're in much of a position to do that.
I'm in by over the holidays, by the way. I just have the usual days off. I don't have holidays. It's Friday and Monday, isn't it? I'm off every other day.